This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 611 for the week of April 20th, 2026. I am free tennis lesson just for you, David T. Cole, and I'm here with whale experiencing mental illness, Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm blue.
Twisted over guitar, Ariano.
Hey, hey, hey.
And wiener dog in a popper vest, Philip Maciek.
Listening to a podcast in your little shed isn't working on shit.
Hey. It's true. Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Before we get into the episode, a little podcast business. Dave is sick or dying or something, so you're
He's doped up or dying or something.
Doped up on Pepto-Bismol and Tums juice. He will be here, sort of, but he was not able to pull together game time, so there will not be one this week. Otherwise, this should be the same Extra Hot Great you know and love, including with a wonderful guest. Joining us, he is a TV critic you've heard with us before many times. It's Philip Maciek. Welcome back, Philip.
Welcome.
Philip.
Thank you for having me.
We are here to talk about season two of Beef, in which Josh, Oscar Isaac, is the general manager at a Montecito, California country club, an environment where members flatter his desire to see himself as their equal, even though he can't afford to keep up with their lavish spending. His wife, Lindsay, Carrie Mulligan, is an interior designer who's increasingly resentful of the club wives who treat her like the help. Both are anxious about the imminent arrival of Chairman Park, Yeon Yoo-jung, a Korean billionaire who has just bought the club and who may decide not to renew Josh's soon-to-expire contract. Engaged club employees Austin, Charles Melton, and Ashley, Kaylee Spaney, happen not only to witness a screaming fight between Lindsay and Josh, but to film its violent climax. Initially, they decide not to get involved, but when Ashley gets a serious medical diagnosis for a condition she basically can't treat without health insurance, the younger couple decides they have no choice but to use their new leverage. The show is created by Lee Sung-jin, who has also written on shows including It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Tuca and Birdie. All eight episodes dropped on Netflix April 16th. We may talk about events from any of them. Let's do the Chen check-in. Philip, should our listeners watch Beef Season 2?
Sure.
Sarah?
I'm going to say no, but.
Okay. It's a maybe for me. After three episodes, I decided this is a bright daylight show. I can't watch it at night. It is too depressing and stressful.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get into it. I mean, let's start with the butt. What's your butt, Sarah?
I mean, my butt sort of is Oscar Isaac's butt. I mean, these are excellent performances. It's sharply observed, but I feel like my issue with it is the same issue that I have with White Lotus, which is these are outstanding performances of people I can't spend time with right now here in 2026. Like, not everything has to be a laugh riot, but it's like, it is really stressful, like you said. And as well done as it is, as much as I love these performers, I'd completely forgotten the William Fichtner of it all. But even he is a one percenter dickball. And it's like, you know what? I'm not there emotionally. Mm-hmm. Bright daylight, like you said.
Yeah. Philip, you were nodding. You agree with this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I said sure, but it's also, I don't think it's a show I would have sought after watching if we weren't going to talk about it today or if I wasn't writing a review of it. I feel a lot of fatigue around shows like this. The thing I would say that led me towards a sure on the spectrum up from a yes, but the thing that was interesting to me about this season was the degree to which it felt, in comparison especially to White Lotus, which is its obvious sort of analog, it felt somehow meaner than White Lotus, but also less sneering in a sort of conventional or expected way. And I think the reason for that is it's a lot more interested, or it's a lot less interested in extremely wealthy people and their problems than it is in people who are not extremely wealthy, but are like religious believers in the ideology of wealth. So it's it's about these characters who all believe or come to believe that making money, rising to the top, is this kind of like value this mm-hmm. kind of like goodness that they could achieve. The thing that's interesting about the show is that it lands sort of slightly less expected punches because it's thinking about people who are devotees to this idea rather mm-hmm. than just people who have a lot of money and behave like snobs and shitheads because of it.
I think that's a really good distinction. And I think that there is a noir set of values in the production. Even if I can't with it right now, I respect it because it thinks and believes that everybody is compromised, both the people who have benefited from late stage capitalism and the people who are like converted belatedly, like Austin, who's like, you know, his updates from, you know, his text updates to his fiance are like, a bee died in the house, I cried.
Yeah.
And, you know, all we need is each other in the beach. And the show, Philip is right, has contempt for all of them, almost especially the ones who start out being like, let's just do as much hustle economy as we need to get by, but then decide they have no choice but to participate, which I think is true, but you're not talking about real people. So anyway, I appreciate that distinction. Good note.
Yeah, the feeling watching The White Lotus, and I like it more than Sarah does, but a lot of the times with the storylines, you're like, you know, some people have real problems. And in this show, everyone has real problems,
mm-hmm.
including the billionaire, as we find out in around episode three. You know, you start to butt up against the limits of like, what can my money actually buy my way out of? Because there may be a line past which you can't get. The stakes are higher for everybody, and that makes their terrible decision making all the more tragic. And there does come a point in episode two when Lindsay, the least likely person I would think to say it, is the one who is like, just don't bother, don't engage, don't do anything, quit your job, let's sell this house. We, you know, we hate it, it's killing us, and let's go do something else. And then he's like, nah. She's like, yeah, you're right. And so they just have to make the affirmative decision to keep descending into, you know, madness and venality and pure evil, basically. Given that the first season competed for awards in the limited series category and won a bunch, I don't think anyone was necessarily expecting there to be more of this. But Philip, do you think the second season overall like makes a strong case for its existence?
Again, I feel like I liked it slightly more than average in this Zoom room, but mm-hmm. feels already that the premise is stretched pretty thin as an anthology concept.
Right.
I like this writer, and I like the casting choices. I like the directing choices. I like the look of both of these seasons. But it feels to me like one of those things where 15 years ago, somebody would have just let this person make a TV show that would last several seasons. And there's a sort of like backdoor shoehorning of several undercooked ideas into an anthology concept. I just love to see this person make a show, like a regular show, rather than continue to try to figure out new beeves to
beeves.
I assume that's how the plural works. Beef after beef, mm-hmm. Until the heat death of the universe. So I don't know. I mean, I like what this group has been doing, but it even this season feels like, is that really a beef?
Mm-hmm. It's sad that Dave is not fully with us because I know one of his peeves, not his beeves, is when you see a lot of texting and stuff on screen, and there is quite a bit of this. We also see, you know, Lindsay on her phone flipping between the various apps where she's sort of keeping, you know, men on a string to see if she may need to use them in the future. Sarah, did you feel like the tech integration here was clumsy or did it feel artful to you?
No, I didn't really notice it. And, you know, like the umpire in baseball, like you just kind of don't want to notice it. I think right. Dave tends to be a little more primed than the rest of us to be peeved by that. I'm someone who just turned off the like keyboard clacking noise on her phone like last year. So I'm the wrong person to ask. I think I only did it initially because it bugged one of your dogs.
Oh.
not gonna lie.
Okay.
That is sort of an interesting rubric to judge shows by here in the 2020s, is in order for it to feel real and organic, you have to have a lot of communication via text. You have to have a lot of DMs and the apps, but like, how do you make that dynamic on television or on screen? And you just have to figure out some way. And if it doesn't exactly work, tough titty. Like when Sherlock first started doing it, like 15 years ago, it felt really not daring, but like that they had risen to a challenge. Now it's just one of those things you have to fit in if you're in the same timeline that we are watching.
Right. So. Well, especially when two of the characters are millennials. And I did think it, it reveals a lot about character, the way they use the medium or the various media. Like when Ashley is in her all hands meeting and she's like getting more and more paranoid about Josh noticing her on a phone, but not to the degree that she stops texting. What did you think about her character, who's sort of at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of doesn't have a high school education? She's the one with this medical diagnosis. Philip, what were your feelings about Ashley?
First of all, Kate Spaney's really good in this. They're all good. Everybody's quite good, I think, including Oscar Isaac's mullet. But I thought Kate Spaney in particular is very good about the way that her performance choices start to seem both extremely like intentional and scheming, and also kind of a little bit outside of her control. I think the scene where she's talking to the chairwoman and starts making up the story about her fiance being a physical therapist, you can kind of watch her not exactly decide to do that lie, but just sort of catch up to the fact that she's doing it.
Yep.
And I liked the way that both her performance and also the way that that character is written, to see the kind of like almost like compulsive ease with which she starts to sort of break the kinds of vows of social life that she had been talking about in the previous episode. And I think it's a clever thing to have her wearing the thrift store Brooks Brothers shirt that she's wearing, because it feels both like an accident and also on purpose. That to me was the most interesting sort of thread throughout this, was watching her specifically kind of turn into that kind of a person, and the kind of person who would do those things, almost like catching up with herself.
Yeah. I think also that that character, and she does a good job of not hanging a light on this aspect of it necessarily, but just illustrating it and not, and letting the writing do or not do what it's going to do, is that, as my esteemed colleague Tara is always pointing out, there is a difference between broke and poor.
Yeah.
And this character and her fiance, I think, sort of straddled that line as a household, as a couple. Like, choices that drive a character are different in each case, I would say. And I think that the writing is like knows more than it necessarily tells us about those fine gradations or not so fine gradations. And that's one of the things that recommends the show to me, is that there are a lot of things that, you know, the show knows about life that it doesn't feel like it necessarily has to dump in dialogue. It does it another way. The only issue is, like I said before, like, these people are all miserable and can't get out of their own ways. And we're doing that here on the ground in Brooklyn. I don't need to watch it happening in Montecito. So that, it's nothing against the show. It's just like, you got to be in a certain headspace that I'm not sure anybody in America's in right now. So that's where I'm coming from with that.
Well, especially too, that it all revolves around this country club, where it's like, in the first episode, Josh and Lindsay are leaving this fundraiser. They're both in a terrible mood. They're already starting to fight. And he gets a call and says, you know, she wouldn't call if it wasn't an emergency. And Lindsay's like, it's a country club. And she's right. But, you know, that this is the setting. It sort of reminded me of, like, based on a true story, where Chris Messina is playing a tennis pro who's also not poor, is broke, owns a house. It's just not good enough for him and his wife. Or, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, where every time we see the country club, someone is having some idiotic fight about some tiny piece of protocol that has been violated or something. And so I do think it's interesting to see the country club as locus of desperate climbers and horrible rich assholes and all of this stuff, that this is where it's playing out and is also like this, you know, portal to hell for everyone who's there. That felt very appropriate.
Like, the expectations of the country club versus what it can actually deliver emotionally, like the William Fichtner character complaining that the food was lukewarm. I was like, if that's your only complaint about country club food, bless, go with God, my son.
Yeah.
Having it set in a country club felt like a choice that the show justifies, but also a choice that maybe you would have rethought at the stage of its premise, right? To sort of put yourself in a position as a show to have to differentiate yourself from this very popular anthology series within the same, that appeals to exactly the same demographic. And it felt like an interesting sort of microcosm. I liked Michael Phelps showing up and a couple of little celebrity cameos and things like that. I don't know. It felt a little bit to me like I both was too familiar with this setting, and also the show was taking a lot of liberties, or not liberties, but assuming that I knew a lot about the appeal of a place like this in a way that maybe I didn't. And I think it foregoes that kind of like detailed anthropological, like here's what all of the different rich people are like kind of a thing. I think in a good way, because it's focusing on, to my mind at least, the right characters to be focusing on. But also you miss that a little bit. Like what exactly is this ecosystem for someone who is paying $300,000 to be in it, right?
Yeah. Right.
So like processy, but for rich gits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And when they show it from the front, I'm like, it's not even that nice. Like, it's fine, but it doesn't seem like it's worth a $300,000 initiation fee plus whatever they're paying a month to go play golf and have flirty tennis.
And they
lessons.
Never are, though. Like, remember that exterior they used to show? It was B-roll, but on Melrose for like every single country club across California had the same B-roll from Based on the Benzes Out Front, 1981. And we're like, her?
But Michael Phelps.
I don't know.
I mean, he did a great job. When they just call him Michael at first. And the show was so dark at night, too, that I was like, is that? And then it was him being a complete asshole. And good for him.
Yeah. Why not?
We got a lot of shows. It's a great time for shows.
It's time to go around the dial. First off with Tara.
The Boys season 5 is something I held off on starting because I knew it was about a supposedly charismatic figure dragging America into fascism even more than other seasons. And speaking of things we don't want to watch right now, that. But it is the final season, and I guess I do want to know how the series ends. So we caught up this weekend. Only 3 episodes have dropped as of this recording. Now, in the world of The Boys, there are freedom camps where suspected starlighters, including Huey, MM, and Frenchie, have been interned. In the first moments of the premiere, Starlight humiliates Homelander at a Vought shareholders meeting by hacking the video system and playing the leaked recording of Homelander from the first season, letting a plane full of civilians crash and die. The Vought machinery spins it as a deepfake, but Homelander decides the boys all need to be executed, so Billy brings Kimiko back from hiding in the Philippines, so the two of them plus Starlight, A-Train, and an ex-Vought TV show writer with worm powers, including tunneling, join forces to bust out their loved ones. The worm lost his job because Vought replaced all of their writers with AI, but he has either got another job or is definitely about to with this incredible spec script he's working on. Let's hear the clip.
Reacher. Massive enters the motel. Woman, you're huge. Reacher, know what they say about huge guys? They have huge cocks.
Nailed it. From there, the season turns into a race to weaponize the superhero-killing virus against Homelander, but also against all superpowered individuals, and since that includes our heroes, emotions are running high. There are a lot of elements that make The Boys hard to watch, from the depressingly recognizable media landscape to a government entirely captured by a corporation to social media misinformation cooking users' brains. The ultra-violence is still worth seeing, in my opinion, but when even the show's creator is out here saying reality has taken all the bite out of what was formerly a satire, it is an even less fun watch than when it premiered. We also did not keep up with Gen V through season 2, but I think resetting the storyline of the franchise to World War II times with the upcoming prequel series is a good move. Interested to see how that changes. For my plug, it's not up yet, but I will have a piece on Defector this week about the Rockford Files. So, you know, keep refreshing Defector until you see it.
Philip, what do you got for us?
So I'm, like many people, a longtime viewer, watcher of Saturday Night Live. It was very important to me when I was a kid. And I have, over the past maybe decade or so, taken a very, like, well, I'll watch a sketch if it comes across the transom or pops up on YouTube or something. But I haven't been paying super close attention to it. But my daughter, who is 10, has recently, over the past year, gotten very interested in learning about Saturday Night Live. And so every night I'll hand select one or two sketches to show her. You know, I started with classics and things that you might associate really closely with the show. She has really, to my mind, idiosyncratic taste in what she likes on Saturday Night Live. She did not think Debbie Downer was that funny.
Oh.
She thinks Target Lady is hilarious. Mm-hmm. She's a big Kristen Wiig doing a voice fan. She hates The Lonely Island.
What? Oh, my God.
I've shown her so many, she can't stand them.
Oh, God.
Is she a Colin Quinn guy? Because we're going to have to talk to her.
I was asking her about it. And recently, this is this week, she said, I think I might like some of them if it were different guys doing them. So not a Quaid in the language of that podcast. Anyway, she doesn't like Lonely Island. She really liked Please Don't Destroy, the recent like Lonelier Island replacement group. The thing that I'm really starting to realize is the sort of generational slant of what she likes. And the thing that I wanted to talk about, the thing that she's been really getting into is this sort of new to this season pairing of two relatively new cast members, Jane Wickline and Veronica Slowakowska. Both of whom are TikTok comedians. They're not the first TikTok SNL cast members, but they are in that sort of first grouping. And Mae has never seen a TikTok video before. She doesn't have any social media at all, but she has a sort of like affinity to their style of comedy writing that I find really interesting. And I like it too. I've been really interested. Jane Wickline's been doing sort of Weekend Update keyboard joke songs for the past couple of years. But this season, the two of them have been pairing up on sort of music videos, both of which I think are pretty good. The first one is from the Melissa McCarthy episode. It's called Cousin Planet. It's about what happens to your cousins after holidays. The universe of Cousin Planet is that they only eat leftover ham. Which I thought was good. There's a more recent one from the Connor Story episode called Car Door that is basically just a very long, heavily produced music video about how hard it is to open new car doors and find the button. I feel like I'm watching the show through new eyes now, and it's been a pretty fun experience. And I recommend those two sketches.
Nice.
It's a particular standouts.
And for your plug.
Oh, yeah. My plug. I have this week up at New Republic a review of DTF St. Louis that does not focus on any of the many aspects of St. Louis life that it gets wrong or doesn't even try to get right.
The Kevin Klein bathhouse or whatever that was.
The Kevin Klein. Well, I mean, that one's right. That's my local pool.
The arch is square. What the fuck?
But anyway, my review's up this week.
Saturday Budding.
Hello. I am not mad at the latest chapter of Untold, which is called Jailblazers. It's about the turn of the millennium Portland Trailblazers, the NBA franchise, and their, I guess, troubles with the law and the town and fans turning on them. But which was the chicken and which was the egg there is really the question. But at the same time, it's not really a question. This, like all other episodes of Untold, pretty much is well enough made, eminently watchable, but at just over an hour, it's like a little too surface, a treatment of several distinct cases. I had this issue with the Brett Favre episode. I had this issue with the Washington Wizards episode that I talked about a year ago on this very podcast. I was writing my review, which I'll link in the show notes for bestevidence.fyi, and I was trying to hack, like, what is it about these that, like, there's nothing exactly wrong with it, but if you go into it expecting a more traditional true crime documentary approach, not in the Oxygen sense, but more in like HBO prestige sense, why does it feel unsatisfying on both that level and compared to a 30 for 30. And I realized I had already cracked this code last year when I talked about the Washington Wizards episode. 30 for 30s tend to have this like pretty strong filmmaker point of view. more of a commentary framework. It's more traditional, but Untold picks a story, gets access to most of the people at the center of it, and then just lets them talk and lets the viewer put it together vis-a-vis the bigger issues. I think that's definitely what happened here. The director, in this case, Sasha Gardner, has not directed before this, but was a producer on The Captain, which was the Derek Jeter series, and may have figured the audience would make certain assumptions about racial profiling at the turn of the millennium in very white Portland, Oregon, and certain ways of commenting on things in the media that was also rather pale, and that they didn't have to belabor the point. But then at the same time, the documentary is also not getting all that granular with the actual basketball. So I think Untold is just like a vibes documentary series, and letting Rasheed Wallace talk is never a bad choice. Like, these are very charismatic dudes. They know how to tell their stories, and that's a legit approach. But I think I now have finally learned, like, this is how Untold does what it does. And if you're not in the mood for like a more hands-off approach to the true crime genre, then you just should not watch that for that reason. So it's out right now on Netflix. I think a new episode actually just dropped as we're recording this today, but this is a more recent one. It's called Jailblazers, and it's, you know, it's fine. It's good. It's interesting. Rasheed Wallace pretending to heckle sports writers was a big smile to me, and along with my review, listed a whole bunch of other basketball and true crime contiguous projects, long reads, documentaries, docudramas. Some of them were great, some of them are not, but that's all in bundled with my review at bestevidence.fyi. And like I said, I'll link it in the show notes. Go whatever your team is in the NBA playoffs.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Philip. Philip, take it away.
Thank you very much. I want to begin by acknowledging what an honor it is to submit now my third candidate to the Extra Hot Great Canon. This is a huge event in my life. I put arguably too much work into this.
Not possible.
Today, I put before you the 20th episode of the first season of New Girl. When New Girl first debuted in 2011, it was widely covered as part of a wave of new sitcoms written and produced by women, alongside Emily Spivey's Up All Night, Whitney Cummings' Two Broke Girls, and Cummings' other eponymous star vehicle, all which debuted that season. Created by screenwriter and playwright Elizabeth Merriweather, New Girl was a strange entrant in this company. It centered on Jess, an aggressively quirky, ultra-twee teacher who gets broken up with by her boyfriend and ends up moving in with three dudes in a shabby chic loft apartment in Los Angeles. The show's first handful of episodes just sort of recite this premise over and over again. What if this zany, sexually confused, hot glue gun-wielding Muppet had to cohabitate with three ordinary guys? It was not especially compelling TV at first, not least because it put star Zooey Deschanel in the position of having to play a gender-swapped elf. It was simultaneously a lot to ask Deschanel to do, and also not nearly enough to ask her to do. One manic pixie dream girl to three straight men. But midway through that first season, the show's writers discovered something. Rather than have Jess be the odd one out, it was way more interesting for Deschanel to play the straight man to a loft full of weirdos. Jess kept her signature felted personality and Narnia wardrobe full of statement pattern-clashing tea-length dresses, but the show worked harder to flesh out what made each of her three roommates even stranger. If the show created and then mocked Jess's stomp-clap hipster femininity, it went way harder on these dudes' alternate visions of scramble-brained masculinity. There's Max Greenfield's finance bro, metrosexual Schmidt. There's Lamorne Morris's failed athlete, Winston. And then there's Jake Johnson's addled, angry, lost Nick Miller, the show's true breakout star. Normal, the episode that I'm talking about today, is a showcase for this evolved version of the show, a series that relies on the balance and chemistry of its bespoke ensemble. The catalyst for this, somehow, is Dermot Mulroney. Mulroney had debuted a few episodes beforehand as Russell, the disapproving parent of one of Jess's students. The two begin as antagonists, but soon Russell, a wealthy businessman, has charmed her with his looks, his wit, and his seemingly miraculously bottomless wallet. After attending a lavish party at his house, Jess falls into a whirlwind relationship with the man that she and all the boys take to calling Fancy Man. At the start of this episode, Jess is in that familiar early relationship stage where she's been happily ensconced in her new boyfriend's bubble. That bubble, in this particular relationship, means that she's been attending loads of shishi cocktail parties and spending every night at Fancy Man's palatial home. Having run out of clean underwear in her overnight bag, though, Jess returns to the loft. While there, she's pressured by her friend Cece to make Fancy Man come and spend the night in their bubble. Before she does that, though, Jess takes a moment to talk through her expectations with the boys, all of whom tend to behave very badly around Fancy Man. For Schmidt, this means being brusquely competitive with Russell, checking the tags of his suits, bragging about his knowledge of the LA sushi scene. In the parlance of our times, Schmidt is anxious that he is being both frame-mogged and status-mogged by the looks-maxing, money-maxing Russell. Winston likes... That was a little risk on that one. Winston likes to play on Russell's racial discomfort, pranking him into scenarios where he becomes self-conscious about his own whiteness. And Nick, who has something between a romantic crush and a father complex with Russell, just can't pull it together enough to seem anything better than off-putting. He greets Fancy Man with a cheese plate upon his arrival, and the adventure begins. If we could get clip number one, please.
Russell, hey. I can show you around. I can show you our world. Way up here, it's crystal clear.
Nick, you're doing Aladdin.
Again? Do you like cheeses, Russell? That's...
Nick,
come it's on. For Russell.
Things go downhill from there. Russell is visibly uncomfortable as Jess prepares the loft's favorite meal, a meal from a box that they lovingly referred to as ethnic noodles, and the whole company has to do battle with the kitchen's catastrophically broken garbage disposal. Jess, looking for a way to salvage the visit, suggests that they play a made-up drinking game native to the loft called True American. In all honesty, True American is why I've decided to submit this episode to the canon. In the realm of invented games and popular fiction, True American easily bests Parks and Recreation's Cones of Dunshire. It tops Ren and Stimpy's Don't Whiz on the Electric Fence. It makes Quidditch sound like shitty nonsense. I'm just kidding. Quidditch already sounds like shitty nonsense.
Yes.
In all seriousness, this show's creation of the True American drinking game is a perfect in-world object of fascination. We learn just enough to sort of get it, but not enough for it to bear the brunt of any real scrutiny. It's a drinking game that has the look and feel of a genuine in-joke friend group tradition, even as it doesn't make any sense to us at home. I'll let the gang explain it. If I could hear it in, please, clip two.
Hey, who wants to play True American?
I'm in. Yeah, I'm in. That sounds like a great idea.
So it's 50% drinking game, 50% life-size Candyland.
Well, it's more like 75 drinking, 20 Candyland. And
by the way, the floor is molten lava.
It's actually 90% drinking, and then it's got a loose Candyland-like structure to it.
But with stakes.
Hey, guys, we doing teams?
Yeah, mm-hmm. All out, ready?
Ready? One, two, three, go.
Two, four.
Wow, I'm with Russell. Perfect.
What, you don't want to be on my team?
Well, I just copied you. You haven't given me any information yet.
Oh, okay. So it starts off, there are four zones. Mm-hmm. An alternate zone is a crazy zone.
And there's a trail of chairs, but the floor is lava.
These are the pawns. They're the soldiers of the secret order. This is the king of the castle.
And remember, everything you hear in True American is a lie, knock on wood.
And it starts with a shotgun tip-off, okay?
Yeah. Oh, that I can do. Shotgun, sure. Oh,
yes! Right. Oh, yes! Yes!
Yeah, there's no one going back now.
One, two, three, four, JFK!
All right, FDR! Go!
Russell, that's my spot!
Russell, you're in the lava, man!
You gotta understand.
Abe Lincoln, George Washington.
Cherry tree!
A loose Candyland-like structure. True American works almost too well. Soon, Fancy Man and the boys are drunk as skunks, and rather than bringing Jess and Russell closer together, the game has pushed her to the margins of her own home. Soon, Fancy Man is blearily offering alpha male business advice to Winston, who's having a whole B-plot about his new job working for a sadistic sports radio host, and humoring Nick about his insane ideas journal. The next morning, our millennial heroes, used to all this late-night binge drinking, wake up enlivened by their evening with Russell, but Fancy Man himself wakes up hungover. All the same, Nick and Schmidt prepare to dazzle him with their pitch for one of the crown jewels of Nick's ideas journal, Real Apps, which is basically a Swiss Army knife in the shape of an iPhone. If I could hear clip three, please.
As my financial business partner, I appreciate you taking the time. All right, Russell said we need a prototype. So, Mr. Schmidt, I now present you Real Apps. The phone obviously goes back here where the phone goes, and then these are all the apps. You've got a Zippo, you've got a fork, you've got a spoon. That's a corn holder. It's also a gentleman's shiv.
Nick, it's a prototype of a prototype at best. Let me see it.
No, don't be mean about it.
Let me see it.
You got a bottle opener.
Come on.
Yeah.
Look at this. There's no brushed steel, no nickel. I mean, it's got none of the baller metals.
Despite lacking any of the baller metals, the boys show off their prototype to the queasy fancy man, accidentally stabbing him in the hand with the exposed corn holder. When Jess tries to bandage his wound with diner napkins and scotch tape instead of band-aids, Russell flees. When Jess tracks him down later in the day, the two have their first fight, an eventuality Jess had been working hard to avoid. And could I hear the last clip, please?
I have something to say to you.
You don't have to apologize.
Well, I'm not here to apologize. I'm here to fight with you, and I don't care if you want to fight or not.
All right, let's fight.
Well, I was prepared to have a perfectly nice weekend with you, and you just give up and you come home.
Because I was bleeding from my hand. I had to go to the ER. I had to get a stitch.
Ooh, stitches. I'm too fancy for a Band-Aid. I'm actually really sorry about that.
Jess, I haven't played a drinking game in 10 years. The only reason I did is because you asked me to. If I want to have a drink, I don't really have to play a game while I'm doing it.
Well, that's my world. Garbage disposals don't work. Elevators don't pass inspection.
Wait, I didn't know about the elevator.
Yeah, it was like the cables were really thin. We signed a waiver. They took $100 off our rent.
That's really not safe.
Well, that's where I live, and those are my friends. And that wasn't even the first stabbing this month. And Russell, my life is just as important as your life. And if you want to get with me, you're going to have to get with my friends. And that is a Spice Girls song. You just had a fight?
I won.
There you have it. The achievement of this show isn't in figuring out the balance of who's weirdest. It's in turning a one-note premise into a hangout comedy with real live energy to it. If you want to get with her, you got to get with her friends. I said already the main reason I chose this episode was to honor the debut of True American, which reappears multiple times throughout the series. But there are two other reasons. First, I think this episode belongs in the canon because it's an example of a phenomenon that seems almost impossible in the current TV production ecosystem. It's a show that got better in season. With so many sitcoms now turning in short seasons, written in advance by a small writer's room or no writer's room at all, there's very little room for the kind of trial and error that turned New Girl from a one-off gag concept into one of the more sustaining hangout sitcoms of its era. The show's writers worked overtime to figure out which dynamics on the show worked and why, to figure out the kinds of jokes each ensemble member could carry, which kinds of guest stars would catalyze their chemistry best. It's an impressive feat, even in a period of time when these things could happen regularly, and it feels like a miracle from the distant past now. And lastly, I want to take this opportunity to say a word for Elizabeth Merriweather, who's become, over the past few years, with her writing partner Kim Rosenstock, one of the most indispensable purveyors of grown-up dramedy on TV. After the success of New Girl, Merriweather launched two mostly okay sitcoms, Single Parents and Bless This Mess, but she's followed that up with, to my mind, two of the most tonally impressive limited series of recent years. In Dropout, Merriweather turned what could easily have been a cookie-cutter ripped from the headlines true crime recitation into a weird and woolly showcase for an incredible Amanda Seyfried. And just last year, she turned the podcast Dying for Sex into a show that was simultaneously the saddest and funniest show of the year. I thus submit Normal in honor of Elizabeth Merriweather, in honor of growing up as both a person and as a TV show, and in honor of JFK, FDR, Dermot Mulroney, and all the other true Americans.
Thank you, Philip. Sarah, you have watched the least of this show, so you should go first.
Well, who is more of an American institution, I ask you, than Mr. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? I don't know how Extra Hot Great turned into a fucking basketball podcast, but I guess that's what's happening. Give yourselves up to it, people.
The best, I didn't talk about this, but the when he slips the note to Winston, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he signs his name with his jersey number on it. It's such a good little detail.
You will die here, in all caps. Yes, it's so good.
I know. And then later he flicks the post-it off his forehead. It's so good. I love that. I really enjoyed this, and True American is definitely at the heart of this, that it's both absolutely authentic as to these like metastasizing drinking rule games that are opaque to those outside them, but then also that moment in the friend group where like the fancy man outsider just like rips a hole in the bottom of a can and starts shotgunning. And you're like, okay,
yep.
I was not familiar with your game, fancy man. I just felt that the vibe of that was absolutely true. There's also always that one guy who's like, would you like to hear about a dream I had last night? And it's like, no, sir, we wouldn't. And the show was also very smart about writing it in a realistic way that it's not Jess being like, and trying to be diplomatic. She's like, no, not at all. You're not allowed to do that. Very, very many good Schmidt lines describing the kid as a tiny little owl in a shirt because he never blinks. I thought it was very funny. None of the baller medals, obviously. The idea when he rolls out in like a towel into the middle of a different conversation during a sexathon with Cece and is just like, we're on a water break. And everyone just sort of accepts that that's a thing, that they're on a water break. Given that, I think the first thing most people who didn't really or haven't really watched the show are going to say about it is like, oh, adorkable. You're not necessarily expecting these like granular and familiar moments of friendship portrayed with such accuracy, but also like very warmly, but also scathingly at the same time. And I thought that was one of the things Dying for Sex did extremely well, mm-hmm. was understand how that friendship was lived, like just on the ground. And I would say the same about this episode. And also that Zooey Deschanel like really sells adorkable, like it's an eye roll sort of in theory, but in practice, like felted personality is brilliant and I'm fucking stealing it, but it's like, you know, people like the Muppets, so I don't know, like she makes it work. This episode I think is an excellent sales pitch for the show, and that's definitely something that makes it canon worthy, is that you're like, even if you're resistant to certain ways in which it is sitcom-y, in other ways you're like, okay, fine. Like, adorkable worked on me. That I also didn't realize real apps and relapse. Like, yep. It just, I did not get there until like minute 19. And then I was like, oh, Jesus, we'll wait. Mm-hmm. And again, Kareem, an institution who that tag at the end where after the balls had been dipped in the shake is just being pushed back and forth across the radio desk. And it's like, oh, it seems that this was not the first time someone was told to do that to show dominance to this host. So excellent presentation. I laughed many times of an excellent episode. I laughed many times. And this is one of those canon axes that I think we don't always see, but it's always refreshing. Like, if you're trying to sell somebody on the show, is this the episode you're going to use? And I would argue, yeah, come in right around here in season one and see how you go.
I'll go next. I agree. This is a great entry point episode, but I think the one a few before this that sets up the disposal moment in this one where we find out how Nick fixes things or doesn't around the apartment, and that he is suspicious of what he calls a fancy fix, meaning one done by a professional in the field of, let's say, electricity. This is why everything in the place is falling apart, because Schmidt sort of lets him get away with half-ass fixing shit because it's very important to Nick and his self-image that he do it this way. And the result of that is the moment where the disposal goes crazy because Russell doesn't know you're not supposed to use it. And then we get Nick yelling, brace me! And the three guys going behind him like they're in a bobsled, like switching back and forth.
Oh, God. So good.
It's so good. And, you know, a lot of this could have been just a retread of Richard, the Tom Selleck character, and Monica on Friends when she also started dating an older fancy man. And, you know, there was a big discrepancy between what life was like for her and for him. But this is feels completely different. When Nick opens the door and he has that tray of what he calls cheese, I'm having watched this twice. I'm not sure that's not just butter. Like, it never gets said, but that's what it looks like. And everything that happens after that is great. I'm not copying him. I love him. We're bowl brothers now.
Copying him, I love him was really good.
You know, I didn't grow up around frat culture, so seeing Russell shotgun that beer is still very sexy to me in a weird way. I can't really put my finger on. And when they start setting up for True American, like, we just saw them, the guys playing it without her when she was out at the fundraiser. Right. And they still have so much beer. How much beer do they just keep in the apartment?
Is there a fridge in every room?
Yeah.
I also wondered that. Yeah.
Or is some of it warm? I don't know. It doesn't matter. This is, you know, we're playing make-believe here, and it's delightful. Calling the iPhone the slippery germ brick. I mean, that, speaking of things that hit close to home, me and my filthy iPhone. You nailed all of the things that make this so smart. And I do agree that it evolves a huge amount over the first season. We just rewatched the show. We bailed a few episodes into the final season, which is not great. But it does figure itself out in such an interesting way. And this is like for a network sitcom of 22 or 24 episodes a season, like this is quite late to be locked in yet early at the same time. I mean, it's a delight to watch. Dermot Mulroney wouldn't necessarily think in a Michael Phelpsian way that he could fit into this ensemble. And he totally does and is great in the part. So there's a ton to love here. And I loved it all. Thank you for letting us watch it again. Dave.
Philip, have you ever watched the TV show Primo? Okay, first of all, you got to watch Primo.
I see.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really good. But there is a game in Primo that I would say holds up to True American. It is called Game Champ.
Yes.
So once you get to the Game Champ episode, you'll know that you're in for another lots of people playing a stupid game treat.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's make this official. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you?
Oh my God. Well, how far can we drag an unconscious man? Pretty as far as the canon.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, for me, for sure.
Yes, for me as well.
All right, me too. So. That means that New Girl Season 1, Episode 20, Normal. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Camp.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right, everybody, it's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has this week's winner.
I do. It's Matt LeBlanc, speaking of Friends, who is going to be the star, if it gets picked up, of a new show called Flint. It's being developed for him to star in at CBS. And hilariously, the Hollywood Reporter story about this is very vague for the first few paragraphs about what nature of show this is, because it's from Evan Katz, who was a showrunner of 24. And so I kept reading it. Okay, he's playing a cop. Okay, is this a drama? And then until we get to LeBlanc's statement where he's like, no, I love the hours of a multicam. It's like, okay, phew. But here's the premise. The show is about a burnt out LAPD detective on the verge of retirement who's blindsided when the city extends his service by 5 years. Determined to get fired, he breaks rules and disobeys orders, which to his dismay makes him an even better cop, which sounds, I mean, pretty kind of perfect for Matt LeBlanc. But I also, when I read it, thought, oh, I really want to see the British version of the show where it makes him a worse cop and like things just keep going wronger and wronger and no one is happy and he's not learning anything. But nevertheless, I'm interested. I will give this one a shot if it gets picked up. And I have to think it's CBS plus Matt LeBlanc. There's no way it won't be. So good luck to him and them.
Sarah, who is our loser of the week?
Speaking of cop shows, it's Law & Order: Organized Crime, which has been canceled after 5 seasons. But that could make SVU watchers winners, because that could mean that Olivia shippers are in for a treat. Perhaps Stabler will head back to / recur on his original show, because that just got renewed for season 225.
Literally 28, which is almost as hilarious as the fake number.
And SVU signature moment. Monkey in a basketball.
That's right.
It's all happening at the zoo.
Well, speaking about something that you're used to having in the schedule, but suddenly it's not there. Do you know what time it is?
Not in game time.
Outro time.
It's time to end the episode. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We chewed the fat on whether the new season of Beef was select, choice, or prime beef before going around the dial with stops at The Boys, Saturday Night Live, and Untold Jail Blazers. Who's that cannon guy? Who's that cannon guy? It's Phil. Thanks. That's my big contribution to the show.
Dave.
Thank you.
He's exhausted.
Finally, we crowned winners and losers of the week because Dave, as we said, is doped up or dying or something. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
anchor me,
Sarah D. Bunting.
Typing is not a special skill.
And Philip Masiak.
Beeves.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hockey.
Hmm.